Before we begin, any question from last time? Okay. So today I'm going to actually switch gear a little bit to tell you about some basic theory of transport in metal. Essentially, why metals conduct electricity, basically. So actually, even well before the establishment of quantum mechanics, there has been a theory of metal already. And it works just unreasonably well in practice. So that's known as the Judah theory. So it's a theory of, if you like, a classical metal, where the particles, you consider them essentially as Newtonian. To begin with, let's consider continuum space. So I actually can talk about momentum, like living in the entire, taking any real value, not periodic or anything. Okay. But with some random scattering. In the sense that, okay, there could be some impurity in my system, so when my electron travels from time to time, it will collide with some of the impurity and scatter to some different momentum, or it could, you know, couple to other things. For example, it can couple to the lattice vibration, it couples to, well, the electrons can talk to themselves as well if you include interaction. But they can all be summarized into the sentence that there's some random scattering there, okay? Now let's be naive. Let's say, okay, they are classical. So what do I do? You write down the Newton second law. Let's call it mass m star, just to, well, you can call it m, doesn't really matter. So imagine a Newtonian particle moving. Right, that's okay. Newton's second law. So this F, we take it as essentially the electric force, the electric field. Well, if you have a magnetic field, you include also the Lorentz part. But I mean, that will also give you interesting stuff. But here, let's just take the simple example. Let's forget about magnetic field. You know, set B equal to zero and just consider electric field. Okay. Well, if that's all there is, then this thing will just keep accelerating forever, let's say if you have a uniform static electric field. So that's obviously not what you see in a metal. Otherwise, superconductor will not be such a big deal. And the reason is, of course, you want something that mimic this, something that gives you the random scattering. Let's say from impurity. Right. If you're honest, then you should add a random force here. But that's pretty, that's a lot of work. Right? That makes the problem much harder. So there is a way to cheat a little bit. That's basically adding a damping force. Yeah. Okay. Yes?
Someone just asked, is the mass complex?
No, it's real.
I guess they're wondering about the star symbol.
Oh, yeah, sorry, okay. I really mean ordinary mass, but just to make connection with the stuff I will be talking about later. For example, in a semiconductor, the effective mass doesn't have to be identical with literally the usual mass of an electron, right? So it can differ. But here, okay, let's just write m for simplicity. Okay. So this is like, classically, it's like, for example, a ball, a particle moving in a fluid, a viscous fluid, for example. This is what you will get. So the idea is every now and then you scatter, you collide with some impurity. After the collision, the outcome is random, right? You may scatter to some random direction, but overall, it cools you down. Okay. The fact that it's proportional to the velocity is because if you move faster, you collide more often,
essentially.
And this tau is, I put it there just to make the dimension consistent. And by writing it this way, you see that tau has its dimension of pi. So tau is has a name, it's called the mean free time. Essentially, if I'm at time scale much smaller than tau, the particle looks free. Right? On average, after tau, my particle collides with something. Okay. And of course, this and there's another notion of mean free path, which is tau times v. That's called the mean free path. Okay. So now let's look at what this extremely naive model gives you. Well, the idea is you accelerate. Let's say electric field is a constant in both space and time. Okay, the simplest case. Okay. So what does that give you? Well, you accelerate for a little while because of the existence of a force. But then you start to see the damping. So after some transient period, the thing equilibrates. And the steady state essentially has a constant velocity. So this term drops out. So the steady state is when the net force is zero. Right? So the things no longer change. That's when the velocity is equal to tau over m times v. Right, that's the steady state. So this naive picture, after some, you may have some initial condition that oscillates quite a bit, that decays a little bit. But after a little bit of time, essentially some number of tau, your velocity becomes stable at this value. OK, what does that mean? Well, that means that if I now look at my current, or more precisely, current density, okay, defined as the electric current per unit volume. Well, what is that? Well, it's every particle contributes to a current of V, because that's the, essentially V is the number of charge passed by a certain area per unit time. So the current is defined as the density, the current density is defined as the electric density times their velocity. Right? In general, it should be an integral if different electron has different velocity. But in this case, this is a constant. Right? So what does that give you? Well, it gives you, there is also an E, right? Because they carry charge E. In this case, they give you E squared and E tau over M. But then there's the definition of conductivity, which is the current density should be the conductivity times electric field strength. So that tells you that the electric conductivity is given by this number. Let me call this sigma zero. And you can actually do even more. You don't have to make it, let's make, instead of a electric field that's constant in time, let's make it oscillating. So suppose I have an electric field that's constant, that's uniform in space, let's say. But in time, it oscillates like this, right? With a frequency omega. Okay. Now you plug this in. And it turns out because you're oscillating at omega, you expect the only difference between that and this case is now this piece, because of the ddt, brings you down to an I omega there. Right? So that gives you over m star, sorry, m over tau minus m times I only. Right, it essentially just replaced that ddt by I omega. So now, again, you plug into this. What do you get? You get J equal to, well, let me just give you the sigma. The sigma is sigma 0, which is this number, divided by 1 minus I omega tau. So this two results, these are the two key results derived within Judah. Yes.
Can you start with the E or the V?
Sorry?
I got a little lost in what steps you were doing.
Which step?
You have E is equal to T, E to the I omega T.
Yes.
Where did that come from?
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
Oh, this one is saying, suppose I perturb the system.
Okay, and then out of that, you're getting the other version of V?
Yes. Yes. So this is my input. I'm asking what's the output. Yeah. I mean, this is what you get with the AC electric field. So these two results, known as Judah formula, as I said, it's derived from an extremely naive classical version of the theory. But it just turns out to work for a lot of metals. Not all metals, but a lot of them. Even though we know that metals don't, electrons in metals shouldn't behave this way, really. So really, why? Right. So first of all, let me just say that it's not that crazy to consider the electrons in the metals moving in the metals as a classical particle. That part is actually not crazy, because we can actually quantum mechanically, we can consider a wave packet of electrons. So what I mean by that, so if I think about a block state, the eigenstate of my Hamiltonian, it's an eigenstate of the momentum, or the lattice momentum. So that's a nice state, because it's eigenstate, but it's pretty useless if I want to think about transport. Because transport is about, moving the electrons from one part of the system to the other part. But the block states, they're everywhere, right, to begin with. So that's pretty useless. So I need some information about real space in order to talk about transport, right? So for that, I consider a wave packet of momentum that's about that's around k and position around x, right? So uncertainty principle doesn't allow me to exactly say that. So that means this statement has to come with an uncertainty in momentum and in space. And I know that for the wave packet, the best I can do is this thing is of order h bar. Right. Fine. I introduce a wave packet that comes with some uncertainty. But let me live with that uncertainty. Well, there is a maximal tolerance on the uncertainty in momentum. I can tolerate it. It better be actually smaller than my actual momentum. Otherwise, it becomes problematic, what I mean by this thing having momentum k. Okay? And in a metal, the most important momentum, which I will actually show you later, it's kind of intuitively also can be expected that the most important momentum is kf. The Fermi momentum. Okay, so I want this to be true. Okay. However, there's another thing. So this 1 over delta k, or if you like, if you can put it 2 pi here, doesn't really matter, is the typical, is the, is the, yeah, sorry, I should do it better. So 1 over delta k from this relation is my uncertainty in position. If I ever want to talk about particles moving around and colliding, this number better be much smaller than the mean free path. Right, because you know, when I travel across a mean free path, my particles collide, my momentum change. So I don't talk about my momentum beyond the length scale of L, the mean free path. But if my uncertainty in position is already larger than that, then I don't know what I'm doing.
I'm sorry, what do you mean? I'm sorry, can you repeat that again?
Yeah, so imagine I have a wave packet. Let's say this is real space. So this thing has an uncertainty of position of order delta x. So the idea is it travels across some distance, and at distance of order L, it collides with something and goes to something else. So this picture makes sense only if this number is much smaller than this number.
Okay.
Otherwise, if I'm in the opposite regime where I have a huge uncertainty in delta x, and the collision actually happens within this delta x, then I shouldn't talk about this state to begin with. So now plugging this relation and this relation, you conclude that this wave packet picture makes sense if KFL is much larger than one. Let me set h bar to be one. So KF has the unit of 1/length. Okay. And that's true for most metal. Well, the usual kind of metal. The kind of metal that doesn't satisfy this is sometimes called bad metal. So let's consider this kind of good metal. Okay, they're much simpler to think about. Okay. So that's the first part. So once we think about the wave packet, they don't look that different from the classical particle. In fact, you can systematically use semi-classical approach to do it. Okay. So that's the Newtonian part. But even if we take this view that this wave packet more or less behaves semi-classically, it still looks somewhat weird. For example, this relation, right? When I say in a steady state, the velocity are all the same. That's obviously in tension with the fact that electrons are fermions. They shouldn't have all the same velocity. Also, another thing is when I write down this relation, this Ne is the number of electrons. So this allows the possibility of having an insulator to begin with, right? But on the other hand, I told you earlier this week that if I have integer number of fermions or electrons per unit cell, then it's possible to have an insulator. So somehow I have to fix that as well. But as you can see that both this problem come from the fact that in this treatment, I neglected the fact that the electrons are fermions. So it's, basically I just have to put that in, and then the problem will be okay. So a better way to put in, yes.
I didn't quite understand that point that you said about the integer number. So conductivity, yeah. Are you taking that as some kind of analog of density? Because
So this is just number of fermions per unit volume, right? And I claim that for insulators, you could have this number being an integer. I mean, okay, it's an integer time over the unit cell volume, right? The volume of the unit cell, let's say A1, A2, A3, if it's a cubic lattice, okay? So this can certainly be non-zero for an insulator. So this can't be really right there, right? So for an insulator, I should expect this number to go to zero, at least if my temperature is well below the gap, right? So as I said, for an insulator, if you are at temperature well much below the gap, there's nothing to excite. And you shouldn't be able to have non-interesting response like conductivity. Okay? I mean, that's part of the thing I will show you in more detail later. Okay, so a better theory that handles this, well, funny enough, will give you essentially the identical results here with this thing being modified a little bit. It's known as, well, actually, there are multiple ways to do it. But let me do a version of that for you. That's called the Boltzmann equation approach. So you may or may not have seen something like this, but it doesn't matter if you haven't. I'll tell you what it is. So the thing that we consider now is actually an electron distribution function. Right, essentially the density of the electron at position x, or r, let me call this r, with at momentum k and at time t. Right. So the fact that I'm considering wave packets means that I can talk about simultaneously about r and k. They come with some intrinsic uncertainty, but we can live with that as long as they are controlled. Small enough. And let me just remind you that if I have zero field, so essentially in equilibrium, this is just the familiar Fermi-Dirac distribution. Essentially, it's constant in space and time. But in momentum, it goes like this. Okay, where this C, K, is the energy, K minus chemical potential. By the way, I've been assuming for a week that all of you know what this is, where it comes from. Should I actually talk about where this comes from? I should?
Yes.
Should have let me know.
Could you just write it as the exponent a bit bigger?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. K over T plus 1. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. So the where it comes from is this. So if I think about the partition function of just, let's just take one fermion state, right? So one wave function that can or cannot, that may or may not be occupied by a fermion. So this, well, we say it's the sum of this guy. But if I have only one state that may or may not be occupied fermion, there are only two terms in this sum. Either the fermion is there or either the fermion is not there. So what is that? That gives you, well, H there is the, or H minus is the energy minus mu times that fermion occupation number. And n, because it's a fermion, it's either 0 or 1. Okay, so that's your partition function. And then, of course, you can see that this gives you this number over t, because c is this combination. And now you see that in thermal equilibrium, that means the expectation number of this thing, which is, if you like, this Boltzmann weight over times n over t times n over z. Right, that's the definition of expectation in the thermal ensemble. Now n equal to 0, this term gives you 0. N equal to 1, this could just give you this. So this is e to the minus c over t over that number, which is this number. Okay. And the key property of this number is if temperature is very low, let's say temperature goes to zero, then this number is one if dac C is larger than zero. Because as T goes to zero from above, then this is positive infinite. So, sorry. Then this is positive infinite, and then this number is zero. While if C is negative, then as T goes to zero, this number is negative infinite. So exponential of that is zero. And therefore, you get one. And that's why at zero temperature we say you have a Fermi surface, because essentially in momentum space you have a surface with a Fermi level k, with a momentum we call Fermi momentum kf, and within this ball, because it is zero, because energy is smaller than the chemical potential, and above which it's empty, so you have a sharp turn here. Yeah, so that's a crash course on Fermi distribution. All right, so okay, let me leave it there. So now let me write down the Boltzmann equation, sometimes also known as the kinetic equation. So that's at thermal equilibrium, no electric field added. Okay, so now you can ask what happens if I add a little bit of electric field. So the equation looks like this. So I'll write down all the terms and then explain to you what each term really means. Remember, this f is now a function of r, k, and t. I think different book use slightly different notation. Sometimes it comes with a negative sign here, but you don't have to care too much. And let me also define vk is the velocity of the particle at momentum k. Okay, and f is really just the force. Okay, so that's known as the Boltzmann equation. Okay, so it's a PDE that can solve. So where does this come from? Okay. It looks a little bit more. Looks a bit complicated. Yes.
What the last term? The last one gives.
There's a partial t, partial f, partial t, but then you call it s. I will explain what this means. Yeah. This term is where you hide all the nasty information you don't want to think about. Yeah. So what this equation really tells you is that the number of particles is conserved. That's it. Now you just write down that word in equation, you get something like this. Well, where does that come from? Well, if I want at some, let's forget about momentum first. Think about space, right? At some space point, I want a change in the, sorry, by the way, I should have said that. So F, K, sorry, R, K, I mean, I only said that it's a distribution function, but maybe I should be more explicit. This means that the number of particles in this region of, let's say, R and R plus some delta R, delta small enough, also K within within some uncertainty, K plus delta K, divided by this tiny volume, this delta R you know what I mean, the volume essentially. So it's the particle density in space and momentum. Yes.
I don't really understand your notation.
Yes.
So you have epsilon to something on the.
Oh, sorry. Particles in this region. Yeah. Right, so it's really the particle density. Except now it's not only in space but also in momentum. So if you like, it's a particle density in phase space. Okay. So now you look at this equation. What does that tell you? Well, if you now think about space first. Right. So if a particle has velocity v, then after a little bit of time, the particle will leave this point. Will move to somewhere else. So I'll be losing that particle. But here, I also have some particle with velocity v. So if the density here and here are the same, then after that time period, the particle here will be moving to here. So I actually don't end up losing any particle. The particle number will be the same. Unless the particle density here is different from here. Does that make sense? For example, if I have slightly less particle here than here, then after a little bit of time, the particle here would have moved out, but I have less particle moving in to compensate that. So I end up losing particle in total. And that's exactly what this term is doing. So if I have a gradient of the density in space, which means my density is not uniform, and if I have some particles moving with a velocity, I end up having either losing or gaining particle within that tiny volume. So that's what this thing is. Okay? So you can check the signs are correct and so on, but that's the idea. And this term is exactly doing that, except in momentum, right? Because F in classical equation of motion is dk dt. V is dr dt. Right, so if this is non-uniform in momentum, then for exactly the same reason, I will be losing particles within that phase space volume. Okay. So essentially, these three terms, or these two terms, if you like, is just tracing the particles as it moves according to Newton's law. Essentially. Now, what is this? This is everything else. Meaning, I know my particle probably doesn't just boringly move according to some simple Newtonian. Once in a while, it collides with something else. So this is known as the collision integral, or the collision term, or sometimes they call it scattering term. It means the same thing. Right? So this is where all the complicated stuff, like random impurity or lattice vibration, also known as phonons, that scatter with the electrons, or electrons can scatter with themselves. I mean, the electrons can scatter with other electrons through interactions and so on. You put all those information here. So this is a gigantic mess in general. Okay. But OK, that's a way to organize your thinking and put in this equation. Yes?
I think both partial derivatives, or is one of them a total derivative?
Sorry?
Is one of these time derivatives supposed to be a total derivative, or are they both partial?
They're both partial. Sometimes it's also written as df dt equal to 0.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. Or sorry, df dt equal to this thing. All right, so I said this is a mess. So what do I do with it? So this equation will be utterly useless if I say literally nothing about this. Okay. So let me say something about this. What can I say? Well, I know one thing, that is this term is 0 if I'm at equilibrium. So if this f equal to f naught, f naught is the expression I wrote up there. Okay. That's just the simple fact that if I'm not perturbing my system, at equilibrium, it's going to stay like this. Right? At the equilibrium, not all these are 0. So this should be 0 because it's time independent. So this thing has to be zero. It, to some extent, that's what equilibration is. Okay. Or the better way to say it is to say, you know, if I look at an instantaneous time slice, the particles are colliding like crazy, right? Some, you know, the particles moving out and moving in. But equilibration means that those processes essentially balance out. And overall, in each phase space volume, unit volume, the particle number doesn't change. So now just putting that single assumption or single statement.
Are you saying that F0, F0 is the only solution for equilibrium for that?
In this case.
Why is that? I think.
No, that's an input. No. I'm not saying F0 is the only solution of this. You know F0 because you know it's a non-interacting fermion. Right. That's the only thing you know. Yeah, you can put in other forms of equilibrium distribution. Put in Maxwell, if it's boson, put in boson. They all make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in this particular case, F0 means that. So in general, that could be any equilibrium solution. All right. So what does that buy you? Well, another thing that we say is that we're only interested in small deformation from equilibration. Okay? So the electric field you typically apply to a metal is pretty small compared with any reasonable energy scale it has. Let's say, for example, the energy you gain by applying the electric field, let's say by accelerating it through a unit cell, for example, that's going to be way smaller than the Fermi energy or any other, essentially any other scale you care about. Right? So we expect at the end of the day, the distribution to be a small deformation from equilibrium. So delta F, I expect it to be much smaller than 1, essentially. Okay. So that means it makes sense to expand everything in terms of delta F, right? And keep essentially only first order. So what does this, now this statement is saying this is 0 if delta F equal to 0. Now if you just expand, what do you get? You get the statement that it should be proportional to delta F. It's literally that simple. Now this thing has a 1 over t time dimension. So you call this number tau. It's literally that simple. So I haven't told you at all how to calculate tau. That's much more complicated. That you need a model. You need to actually know how the electrons collide with impurities or collide with lattice vibration and all that. But at the end of the day, you get a number tau at this order. There's nothing else you can get, essentially. So now you can actually put this into this, and it becomes a solvable equation. The rest is just solve some PDE. Does that make sense?
Do we put tau there just because that's the only time scale problem?
Well, I haven't introduced any time scale at all here, right? So now by doing this, I'm saying I need to introduce a time scale now. I call that tau. It turns out will be the same as tau here, but that's the way I wrote, suggested by the way I wrote. But at this stage, you don't know yet. All right, so now let me solve it for you. Let's have a 5-minute break, and then I'll solve it for you after this. Yeah. Now let me solve this Boltzmann equation for you. But let me solve it to the lowest order. As I said, the electric field you typically apply to a metal is pretty weak. But let's solve it only to leading order, and that's enough. So
you get different.
What do I keep? I want to keep terms that are first order in the electric field and delta F. Right. Another thing is, let me assume that my electric field is space independent, so it's a uniform one. So it could depend on time in general. That's fine. Okay. Let me also assume that temperature is uniform. So I mean, you could perfectly consider a spatial gradient in temperature. That gives you thermal response, thermal conductivity, and so on. But let's not do that. Just keep it simple. Now, if everything is uniform in space, there's no reason for this term to exist, actually. You expect a uniform response, in which case F doesn't depend on space. So this term goes away. So gradient RF, I expect zero. Okay, so that drops out one term. Now, you look at this term. So this term is proportional to E. And I already said I only want to keep terms first order in E. So in this gradient KF, let me forget about the delta F part. I only need the F0 part. No. So I don't want something that's like E times gradient delta F. That's too high order. I don't want to consider that. So essentially, that EE dot gradient KF becomes EE dot gradient KF naught. But F naught is there. You have the expression there. So in particular, F naught is a function of CK. Yes?
Is this big T that you said is uniform, what does that mean?
Sorry, this is temperature. So it's the T in that Fermi distribution. That temperature. Yeah. By the way, KB equal to 1, in case you're wondering where's KB. So temperature is now measured in unit of energy. Okay. So this thing, okay, so it's just a partial derivative. You realize that this thing is this, partial C, partial K, times partial F, partial C. Right. Chain rule, if you like. But this thing is defined as the velocity of the particle, right? So what I end up getting is EE dot velocity times df c. Sorry, df zero. Okay. So that term becomes some known thing, right? So of course there's the thing that partial TF is partial T delta F, because the F0 part has no time dependence. And as I said, the collision integral, I define it to be delta F over tau. So now I have all my terms ready. I just solve it. And it's actually a pretty simple equation, because now it's linear. Right? It's linear in delta F. Again, let me assume that the electric field time dependence is also a simple one. Let's call it E times E to the minus I omega T. So again, I expect my delta F to be delta F, T to be delta F times E to the minus I omega T. Right. If you like, this is an ansatz. You put in the equation, you realize that it solves your equation. So now what is the solution? Well, the solution, so it's a linear, so you can plug it in yourself. And you can see that the solution becomes this. So remember, this is solution in K and T. Sorry, this is solution in K, because I've already absorbed the T dependence as this e to the minus omega T. Right? And I've already required F to be space independent. So the only dependence is really on momentum, K now. Okay. So you can see that it looks like this. At xk. Okay, so this is a linear equation. By the way, once you do this, the partial t term becomes just I omega. That's where this I omega comes from. Otherwise, it's just a linear equation. Okay, so what does that mean? It actually tells you a lot already.
Is that limit there?
Sorry?
Is that limit? The final dash limit?
The evaluation.
Oh yeah, evaluated at, so this is a number, so this is a function of C. I'm saying you take that derivative, it has a C dependence. So I'm saying you evaluate at C, K. Yeah. So what is this thing? Well, let's say if omega is zero, right, so you drop this part, what does it look like? I won't show you the derivation, but you can check yourself maybe later, that this distribution looks like this. So if omega is zero, and also if I assume temperature is zero, so I'm at ground state, right? So if originally I have a Fermi surface, let's forget about lattice for a moment. Just think about the circular, simplest kind of Fermi surface, right? If you originally have a Fermi surface like this, then this new distribution is doing something like this. I mean, that this drawing is exaggerated, but it's as if I'm moving the entire Fermi surface slightly away. By how much? Well, this displacement in K is basically E tau. So it's as if this electric field accelerates my particle for a little while, but it stops at time tau because it gets collided. Right? So that's more or less the picture you get from the Judah approach by solving that naive classical equation of motion. Except you're now moving the entire Fermi surface. You're not just saying the particle, each particle has that the same velocity. Rather, it's like the change of your velocity.
How do we see that the Fermi surface moves from that equation up there?
Yeah, that takes a little bit of imagination, but.
So you basically have to solve for your distribution function.
That is the solution. You should have to take the derivative and plug it in.
Yeah, because for one thing, if this thing looks like a delta function. Because as t goes to zero, the distribution function itself is like a step function. Right? So what is this telling you? This is telling you that this thing will be non-trivial only near the Fermi surface, where this thing is like a delta function. And now you ask, how much does it change? Well, this much. And v dot e, is, if you look at this figure, that's basically this direction is e. Right, you look at how much particle you've gained here by this uniform shift, that's that number. OK, so now you have this new distribution function. You just ask, what's the current? The current at equilibrium is zero. Now, let me do it in general D space dimension, but it doesn't really matter. It's K. So that's the proper expression of current. Yes?
I think I might not have understood what
you're
saying. When we're moving our Fermi surface, did we say that the Fermi surface is getting deformed in any way?
Yeah.
Or is this the same?
It's more or less the same shape,
yeah.
But you uniformly shift everything a little bit by this tiny amount.
Okay, but like so it'll still, like, as you drew it, so it's still a circle remaining.
For example, yeah. Well, remember, this is a tiny number. This is okay. I should have told you that this, I assume, is much smaller than KF.
Does the origin shift?
Everything shifts.
Or is it just cubed?
Sorry?
Does the origin at K equals 0?
No, the origin doesn't matter because deep down here, it's like this thing is 0. So there's no, so delta F is 0. So you basically look at the equilibrium value. Equilibrium value saying deep down it's all 1. Yeah. So the only change really happens very near the Fermi surface. So now look at this value. First of all, this vanishes if F is F0, because let's take the circular Fermi surface, right? Let me just take the Fermi circular Fermi surface for you. So I take C K to be K square. Over 2m, let me call it m star. That usually means that's called the effective mass. So it's minus mu. So this will be the case if I have a circular or nearly circular Fermi surface that's significantly smaller than the entire Brillouin zone. So then vk is pretty simple. It's just literally k over m star, right, the Newtonian expression. Now you plug this into this, you realize that for the F0, which is rotationally invariant, this thing has to be 0. So now essentially you only need to consider the delta F contribution, which is this. Now you just plug in, right, do some integral. So what you will get is that you, again, as I defined, J is sigma times E. And also let's take this function to be basically a delta function. Because practically we're always at pretty low temperature. And then you can, this integral becomes really simple. And you can see that delta, sigma is basically E square tau over 1 minus I omega tau times this thing, which is density of state, C equal to 0. Hopefully you still remember what this thing is. Well, let me just remind you. This is equal to d dk over 2 pi d delta c k minus, well, in this case, 0. So if you plug in something like this into an integral like this, it's not surprising that you get a density of state. Yes?
In the C of k, why is there a minus mu? I thought we were C of k is 0 when k is 0.
No. This is 0 when k is equal to the Fermi surface,
Fermi
momentum. Times this number, vx square. So this expectation means an average over the Fermi surface. So essentially, for example, in 3D, that would be something like, remember that in 3D, the angle integral is something like d phi d cosine theta, where theta goes from 0 to pi and phi goes from 0 to 2 pi. That's your solid angle integral. So this expression is like saying I'm averaging this cosine square theta. Because Vx is like, if I choose a direction, that's my cosine. So this in 3D, if I divide by the total volume for pi, in 3D, this gives me 1/3 of Vf, the absolute value of Vf. Oh, actually, I mean, the easier way to say is Vx squared plus Vy squared plus Vz squared, that gives you Vf squared. So each one should give you 1/3. Anyway, if you do all this for a circular Fermi surface, at the end of the day, you get this. Okay, because there is a relation between density of state and the electron density. So this is exactly what you get with the Judah approach. Yeah, I encourage you to figure out how you go from here to here exactly on your own, just to familiarize yourself with what this number means. Okay.
What's the significance if we have like a complex number, a complex response of some sort? Like, there's some, could you comment on that?
Oh, this one?
Yeah, so.
Oh yeah, you can always take the real and complex part, the real and imaginary part of it. Right? The real part means the dissipative part. The imaginary part is more like optical response. So you can.
So if you comment on that, what does the imaginary part really tell us?
Well, the imaginary part doesn't dissipate. Right?
If,
I mean, it's saying your the current you induce is always out of phase with the applied electric field. So it doesn't you're not dissipating energy. Right, it's only the real part that dissipates energy. So you can, yeah. But yeah. Actually, one can say more about that, but maybe that would be too much more. Yeah, okay, so essentially I spent a lot of effort to justify a pretty dumb-looking classical result for you. And it turns out that's right. Of course, this result will be useless if I don't say anything about what tau does, right? Essentially, I'm just telling you that this unknown number is related to another unknown number. That's not particularly useful. Oh, it turns out people do know quite a bit about tau, at least in simple metals. But let me just tell you the result. I won't actually go into the derivation. So what does tau look like? So that depends on the exact nature of the scattering. Okay. So for impurity scattering, right, so meaning I don't have a perfect lattice from time to time I encounter some junk, some dirt somewhere. Okay. That one you can calculate. Assuming that the impurity is dilute and reasonably weak, you can calculate within some perturbation theory, essentially. And some second order perturbation theory will give you an expression that looks like this. So if you know Fermi golden rule, this should look familiar. But have you guys seen Fermi golden rule in your quantum mechanics class?
No.
No. Okay. Okay. Then don't worry too much. It's essentially this is okay. This is a pretty generic perturbation theory result, saying that if I have a state and now I turn on some time dependent perturbation. How long will that state survive? In general, it comes with some half-life, some decay life. So after this number tau, this time tau, you expect that state to have essentially decayed. Okay? And that's given by some sec. You can calculate that within some second-order perturbation theory and so on. So this comes from the matrix element of perturbation, very roughly speaking. Okay? There are more sophisticated ways. Ways to improve that, but roughly speaking, this is the strength of the scattering Hamiltonian, and this is the impurity density. Which is probably intuitive, because if I have denser impurity, the electrons get scattered more often. But the important thing is, it's a number. What I mean by that, it's it goes to a number that's larger than zero as temperature goes to zero, right? Because there's no information of temperature. It's just a scattering problem. It turns out that's pretty much the only source of scattering you have that does this. All the other kind of scattering, they vanish as temperature goes to zero. So at very low temperature, these are the predominant source of scattering. Okay, if you raise the temperature a little bit, things become much more complicated. Many other things kick in. Phonon electron scattering, by the way, phonon means essentially lattice vibration. Typically, people spend much more time in solid state class talking about phonon, but I'm not going to do that here. But just lattice vibration. Right, and then the expression looks much more complicated and so on. But there is a regime where things are actually simple again. Phonon scattering. If you don't know what phonon is, it's just lattice vibration. So lattice vibration behaves as some kind of bosons. The thing is, if at low temperature, the bosons have their own behavior. They probably also couple in some complicated way to the electron. But if I have at high temperature, I'm at high temperature, specifically much larger than a temperature scale known as the Debye frequency or Debye temperature. So if you don't know what that is, it's just essentially the highest energy a phonon can kick, or highest frequency your lattice can oscillate. There is an upper bound there. So if you're at a temperature much above that frequency, then phonons essentially behave like classical ideal gas. Phonons become classical. So what does a classical particle do? Just ideal gas at some temperature. Well, you have equipartition. Essentially, your phonon number is proportional to KBT. That's classical equipartition. It's saying your energy is proportional to KBT. Well, in this case, phonon energy equal to the energy of each individual phonon times the number of phonons you have. So your number of phonons should be proportional to KBT if your temperature is much larger than the bifrequency. Now, you essentially treat these phonons as some kind of impurities, except their density is proportional to T. What do you get? You get 1 over tau proportional to T. Yeah. Sorry?
Can you raise the board?
This is the lower one, sorry.
There's one behind
you. Yeah, somehow the mid one doesn't respond. But can you see that? I can write it here. So equipartition. And phonon proportional to KBT. And therefore, if you blindly consider it as some kind of impurity, you conclude that 1 over tau is proportional to T.
And so everything inside the integral is it just a constant?
Sorry?
Everything inside that integral is just a constant?
Yes. Well, strictly speaking, you need some justification. But let me not do that for you. But essentially, yes. Yeah, so now what does that mean? Yes?
Naively speaking, doesn't the phonon, like, it's a quantum particle, right? So
yeah.
So it can be vibrations.
Yeah.
So we expect that at t equal to zero, there's no phonons.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Shouldn't there be some quantum fluctuations of phonons which interacts with electrons or something?
You can actually do the calculation. They all vanish as t equals to zero.
Okay.
So now you take those results. What does that mean? Now you think about, instead of conductivity, let's think about resistivity. It means that at temperature much above the debye frequency, it's proportional to T. As temperature goes to zero, it goes to a constant. Now that by itself is already a non-trivial statement. And most metals do that. So, and by the way, if you have multiple sources of scattering, let's say you have, now you say, okay, I don't want to consider only one of those. I want to consider simultaneously I have impurity scattering, phonon scattering, maybe also electron-electron scattering. What do I do? Well, it's essentially a circuit in series, right? What you do is each source contributes separately to the conductivity. Right. For example, if I want to consider impurity scattering and together with phonon scattering at high temperature, that means I get a constant plus something times T. Right. Essentially because, you know, scattering, if you think about the scattering, it's a circuit in series. Or if you like, the scattering rate adds if you do provision theory. So now a typical metal looks like this. At very high temperature, it's linear. And then it does some weird, it does something weird in between. So here it's linear, that's the electron phonon. Here, actually, it's also electron phonon dominated, but typically, but the math is more complicated. Here's the math is more complicated. If you calculate it, it's something like t to the fifth. Here, it turns out electron-electron interaction, which I haven't talked about at all, comes in. Typically, it goes as t squared, and now there's a constant. So I told you what happens here and what happens here. Anything in between is more complicated than what I can cover. Yes?
What's the power of t between t squared and linear?
Fifth. Yeah, I can't draw it properly, but yeah.
Where is that coming from?
Electron phonon. But below the bar. Yeah, because then you have to seriously treat the phonons as quantum particles, putting the Boltzmann, sorry, putting the boson distribution, and you know, carefully do it.
Mechanism for the T to the fifth.
Sorry?
What's the mechanism for the T to the fifth
dependence? Electron phonon.
Oh, electron phonon.
Yeah. I mean, there could be other. I mean, this is just with quote unquote typical metal. There are all sorts of weird metals that don't obey this, and. In fact, one of the holy grail of condensed matter physics is to explain the resistivity behavior of a certain class of material where above a very low temperature scale, well below the bifrequency, it's all linear upward. So it's a much simpler behavior than this figure. It's above some scale, it's like all linear all the way up. The slope doesn't even change as you cross through the bifrequency. Nobody knows how to explain that. So if you know how to explain that, then essentially you solve the problem of high temperature superconductor. So this kind of thing, people give it a very uncreative name that's known as the strange metal. So this is a weird case where the simpler behavior is harder to explain, much, much harder. All right, so now you can ask, well, is there all to it, right? After all the effort of doing this Boltzmann whatever thing, you get a classical result. Okay, why should I bother with that? Well, it turns out it can do more. The quantum particles moving on a lattice can do more than just the classical or semi-classical Drude diffusion. So there are many fun examples, but let me talk about a quite illuminating one. It's known as the Bloch oscillation. So this is the regime. If I consider tau going to infinity, what does that mean? That means I'm at very low temperature, so phonons are pretty much suppressed, and my lattice is very, very clean, almost no defect. It's unrealistic for an actual solid, but people in cold atom optical lattice, sometimes they can get close to that regime. So now if I'm at that regime, what happens? You can ask. So it looks like my conductivity blows up, first of all. But what does that mean? No, turns out it's not. So let's just look at the Drude theory. Right. Turns out that's enough. So if I look at the semi-classical, actually, it doesn't matter if you look at Drude or Boltzmann. The semi-classical equation of motion now becomes this. With no damping term, right? Because damping term is proportional to 1 over tau. This is probably the simplest ODE you ever see. Let's say E is a constant. Let's even make it simpler. Let's say one dimension. So 1D, let's take 1D, E is just a constant. Solve it. Well, you get K equal to EE T. Plus a constant, let's say K0. But now, the difference is that, different from the classical case, is that you now live on the lattice. So remember, K is defined within a Brillouin zone. In the 1D case, it's, let's say, take it to be from minus pi to pi. Let's take the lattice constant 1. So how do you reconcile this two? This thing doesn't even look periodic. Well,
K0
as what?
G. I suppose lattice vector.
That doesn't change because it's linear in T. you still change t. So what happens is this. Let me take your favorite band structure, which is a 1D type binding model with nearest neighbor hopping. Remember that one, you have EK equal to, well, I wrote minus 2t cosine k, but since I have t here, so let me call this thing 1 over m, right? Or 1 over m star. Because if you expand cosine, you get a 1/2 k squared. So, if I look at this structure, what does it do? Okay, I start from some k naught, just one particle. Now I evolve with this equation. So after some time t, I move. Then I move to here, my zone boundary pi. But that's same as here. So essentially what happens is I move to here, it comes back here, I move again. So I'm oscillating.
Where is the energy?
That's the thing. The energy goes up and down, also oscillating. It's not dissipative. So it's infinite.
So it seems that you can't.
Yeah.
You are always accelerating the particle.
You're always accelerating the particle, but it's also oscillating. Because k is defined only on a circle, right? So you should really think of this from minus pi to pi as a circle. This is where you define your k. So what's going on is that you're moving like this on the circle. Well, you say that can't be literally true, because let's say I take the simple the other example. That I showed you on Monday, the almost free space, right? So there, okay, I do have something here, right? Remember this picture, that you have some energy level here with a gap here. So if this gap is zero, like the ordinary parabolic band, then what will happen is you go from here and then it goes on, right? Somehow I'm saying when they have a gap, this thing doesn't happen provided this gap, let me call this gap delta. Delta is much larger than EE times the lattice constant. Let me call it A. Yes?
We have tunneling effect after some time, like between the bands.
Sorry? Yeah. That is exactly what I'm going to say. If this is true, your electric field is too weak to cause an excitation from here to here. There's an energy penalty there, right? So of course, if you wait long enough, that will happen. Yes. But the suppression is pretty good, actually.
So you apply a potential.
Yes.
And your current oscillates back and forth.
Yes.
Because the speed of the particle is going up and down.
Yes. Yes, precisely. So now, for example, this is the simplest equation you can possibly solve. So now let's solve for everything, right? For example, what about my velocity, right? Remember, velocity is defined as partial E, partial K, right? So it's something like So it's something like sine K over M. Right, so near k equal to zero, that's the k over m. But as I said, sine k is eet. Let's just to make things simple, let's set k zero to be zero. Doesn't really matter. So now this gives you sine eet over m. So you see that it's oscillating, the sine. Of course, x is just the time integral of vt. That's just what, 1 over m ee times what, cosine, let's say x 0 is 0. So it's going to be something like cosine, I think 1 minus cosine ee. So it's also oscillating. Yeah.
So if the band was full with electrons.
Yeah, then you don't observe that effect. Exactly. Yeah.
Sorry. When we derive the Joule theory, we don't consider the lattice spacing.
Oh yeah, that's. Yeah. No, but this is just semi-classical equation of motion, right? So, if you like, the semi-classical equation of motion is also here.
Yes, but this condition, we don't consider the lattice spacing that we have.
Well, we secretly did, because when we do things like this, we do have assumption that is the electric field won't induce a jump for the electron to another band. I didn't tell you that, putting that in that formula. Oh, actually, there is a way to put it there. You just introduce more indices and then put that information into the collision integral, for example. But in many of the simplifying features, we typically assume that interband transition doesn't happen if the field is weak enough. Typically, it is. Right? So actually, there are literally experiments demonstrating this. You take an optical lattice with some atoms moving in it, and then you make it vertical. So you have like a lattice like this. So gravity will do the job of E. And what you see is the atoms doing this. They don't just fall. So that's what Bloch tells you. Apparently, it's true. Okay. Of course, if tau is not strictly infinite, it's finite, you get some crossover from this kind of behavior to the more ordinary Judah kind of behavior. That's more complicated.
So would you still see, imagine you had a perfect metal.
Yes.
Voltage.
Yes.
Do you still see like a net positive current which is oscillating, or is it literally the current oscillating?
It's literally oscillating. What happens? Okay. What happens? Okay. You can ask the following question: if my tau is large but not strictly infinite, what happens? Then you start to see a net current, but oscillating on top of that. Yeah. The net current is still gonna be proportional to tau. Sorry. No, actually, there is not going to be. Yeah, there is not going to be proportional to tau. You have to be a little bit careful. Yeah. So that's it for today. So next time, I'm going to tell you another effect of the lattice on the transport, known as the Berry phase. So see you next week.